Thanks for listening to this Eastlake podcast. Everything we do is supported by the generous donations of our local and online community. If you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by visiting eastlakecc.com. We hope you enjoy this week's message.
Hey, everybody. I'm glad to be back in wherever I am, Seattle. I brought my black jeans and my Patagonia, and then I got off the plane. I was like, oh, it's a different country. I saw people in shorts. And I flew in. I saw the mountains, not just the clouds. There's a full moon. I was like, oh, I see why people live here. Yeah, I'm from Michigan, which is a little like Seattle, except colder. And a whole lot flatter. Apparently that was like really funny to like two people. I don't really want to, I want to get right into it because they give me a countdown clock and there are only 39 minutes on it. So I kept thinking about some things. When the music was happening and these quotations were being put on the screen, and here are lines that stuck out to me. Einstein was talking about the reality of oneness. And I was thinking to myself, is that true? Is that really true? Is there a oneness to reality? I mean, so much of our experienced life is about separateness. I live in a different state. I like a different football team. I'm over here and you're over there. I have this particular skin color. You have some other skin color. And actually, now that I'm thinking of it, almost our entire life is organized around our separateness. That's how we come to know who we are. And yet, Einstein is talking about the reality of oneness. Is that really a true thing? Or here's another one that I saw up on the screen. The story of any one of us is the story of us all. That's another way of saying the same thing. The story of any one of us is the story of us all. That's the kind of theme I want to hover around today. What is this world? What is this thing? What is the nature of reality, or reality with a capital R? What is this world? What are any of us doing here in the first place? What is the nature of reality? What is our view of reality? And what are the consequences of our perception of things? Because it certainly has consequences. What we imagine life to be, and even what we imagine the future to be, affects how we live our very ordinary, normal lives. That's what I want to hover around. So, of course, I want to share a poem today, because I'm like apparently the guy who shares poems, I've been told. So I just keep just trying to, you know, fulfill people's expectations. Just like Eastlake, always fulfilling people's expectations, theologically. So I want to share a poem. I want to talk about the history of human thought in major generalizations, which is another way of saying a sermon, major generalizations. And what else do I want to do? I want to talk about end times, because that's always fun. I want to return back to some lines from the poem. So that's where we're going. Apparently your theme for the summer was evolve, which is another way of saying, let's just come up with a theme so people can say whatever they want. But I will try to speak to it in some respect. So here's the poem. It's called The Summer Day. It's a poem by Mary Oliver. Who made the world? Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who made the world, this world? Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. See what I mean? Who made the world? This world. Now she snaps her wings and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass. Do you know how to fall down into the grass? I'm just curious. How to kneel down in the grass. How to be idle and blessed. How to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. What a waste of time, strolling through the fields. She could be updating her profile pic. That's not in the poem. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Not a whole lot needs to happen, except for a poem like this to work on you, like a river over a stream bed. How do the stones get smooth? Well, it takes a really long time, and a few storms, and a few droughts, and the continual movement. That's how I feel about this poem. Like, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? This is a question that has to be lived. And in a way, at least for me, it feels like I'm just beginning to wake up to such a question that really you and I are worthy of even asking such a question. What is it that we plan to do with our one wild and precious life? I would like to live my life a little like this poem. I'd like to find out what she means by praying like this. Falling down in the grass. Or T.S. Eliot says, what's his line? He says, find a place where prayer has been valid. I suppose that can be a cathedral, a place where prayer has been valid. It can also be a field and a grasshopper whose jaws move back and forth instead of up and down. I'd like to learn to pay attention like this. Now, why? What does it have to do with evolve or evolving? Well, I don't know. We'll see if it does. I'll see if I can come up with something. What is our relationship with the world? What is this world? You know, at football games, they probably don't do it here in Seattle because it's too liberal. But they, you know, sometimes they'll hold up John 3:16 signs. You ever seen that at a football game? Happens in Texas. And what is that verse? What is that verse? The verse is, for God so loved the world. Raise your hand if you've heard that verse. Yeah, I just felt like a high school teacher. I used to teach high school. Raise your hand and they would never do it, but. For God so loved the world. Do you know what the word is in Greek? Cosmos. For God so loved the cosmos. Is that true? Is that true? Whatever God is, I'm not here to tell you whatever God is. I think that's a fair, whatever God is, this text is saying, For God loves the cosmos. For God so loved the cosmos. Now, I want to ask you a quick question. Do you think most Christians have that kind of relationship with the cosmos? They love the world. The cosmos. No! Many Christians want a ticket out of this world. That's what they think Christianity is. I get a free ride out of here. And there's a whole apocalyptic version of Christianity, which is like, at any moment, Jesus is going to appear in the sky. I'm going to shoot away like in a jetpack and take off out of here because this world is messed up. And in this famous verse that people hold up at football games, we're told, God loves the cosmos. That love is intertwined into the furthest reaches of the galaxy. And whoever penned that line, John, had no idea how vast the universe really was when he said, for God so loved the cosmos. Okay. Anyway, that was my introduction. Einstein also, by the way, said the most important question we can ask is whether or not the universe is friendly. I mean, what do you think? I mean, don't tell me right now because then we'll get into this whole weird thing, but do you think the universe is friendly? Do you think the universe is worth loving? The cosmos is worth loving? Or is it a hostile, random, dark place of uncontrollable forces of which you're just an infinitesimal speck, which you are, but it is utterly unfriendly? Now, I know those aren't like, you know, the first thing you do in the morning is get up and contemplate such a question, but it's in the background of almost everything. It's in the background of our addiction to distraction and television and social media because of the dread, the existential dread of such a question. Is the universe a friendly place? We don't want to look at it. So, I'm going to give you a drive-through history in four phases of humanity's relationship with reality, particularly nature. So, capital N nature or capital R reality, drive-through. And I'm going to make some big generalizations. So, if you're like a historian, anthropologist, smarter person than I am, okay, I'm not telling the whole truth, but I don't have time to, and I don't know what it is anyway. So here's a drive-through version, and it's important because I want to try to identify what is our relationship with the natural world, with Mary Oliver's poem in the background, with the grasshopper's jaws moving back and forth. So in antiquity, even around the time period when the Bible was written, most cultures, probably all of them that we know of, had a view of the natural world as cyclical. That everything came in cycles. How do we know that? Because they looked up at the moon and saw a cycle. They noticed that the human feminine body has a certain cycle connected to this orb in the sky that changes, called the moon. Everything was cyclical. And you had the cycle of the seasons, correct? You are just coming out into paradise from hell, you know? That's the cycle. And one's relationship with that cycle was much more intimate in antiquity than what you and I experience, most probably. We know this from religious practices and art and the very little bit we have in writing of ancient cultures, but mostly we're going on the work of anthropologists and historians and things like that. So an example of that, even in the Bible, is that every single festival, every single one in the Bible, and every single sacrifice was connected to the agrarian cycles. They had an intimate relationship with wheat and barley and pomegranates and figs and dates and almonds, and they offered portions of them to God and to the priests and to the community because they were intimately connected to the cycles of rain, and sunlight, and the moon. Even the calendar was not solar in the biblical times, it was lunar. So, why is that important? My main point is that it seems like humanity evolved, I told you I'd work in that word, into a kind of conscious, and some of it is of course unconscious, but conscious intimacy with nature. With, and here's the most important part, the death-birth cycle. Everything dies in the end and too soon, says Mary Oliver. And it's so it makes life precious. And, of course, there was especially a sense in antiquity that you could do nothing about it. You're just in these cycles. We, in the modern world, we live with a kind of illusion that we're outside of all that, but in antiquity, they didn't have that illusion. They were intimately connected. And at the whims, even, of nature, which they often associated with gods and goddesses, but there's a major misconception that people in antiquity just were really afraid of the gods, and they, like, you know, had to, like, cut up animals and be like, please, please, we can't make it through the day. No, that's most likely not the case. The idea of sacrifices and festivals was because they had an intimacy with the natural world. And they lived it with a kind of wonder. I'll give you a biblical example. Isaiah says, I looked up in the stars and wondered who created all these. That is someone living from a place of wonder, mystery, and awe. It's like the first line of Mary Oliver's poem, Who Made the World? So, anyway, that's the cyclical view. And another point to it is that it was sacred. Nature itself was sacred. It wasn't resources like we talk about them. It was sacred. There was something sacred about the natural world of which we were all a part. Okay, enough on that. Around the time of the Persians, there was some cultural development. Persians, Greeks, Romans all came in succession. And they had an intuition about life and about nature and about reality that was a development. And the intuition had to do with a Greek word called teleos, meaning kind of a direction. That history had an aim. That human beings and civilization and culture was going somewhere. How many have ever heard someone talk like, yeah, history's going somewhere? Well, that comes from really from the Greeks, which is different, a slight different than everything is cyclical. Well, winter's coming, summer's coming, winter's coming, summer's coming, birth, death, endless cycle. The Greeks largely came along and said, no, there's an aim, there's a purpose, and Christianity was born out of that world. The idea that there's a kingdom of God is 100% Greco-Roman. In fact, even, this is a slight detour, the idea that there's an immortal soul, that I'm somehow not nature, there's some immortal soul, that's Greek. Paul's famous line where he says, to die is gain, people sometimes quote that at funerals, that's a quotation from Plato. Did you know that? To die is gain. He came up with that. So anyway, side note. But history had an aim, a purpose, was going somewhere, and here's the most important part. They begin to dream of a golden age. The cyclical view didn't have a golden age, but they started to dream of a golden age. Now, whether or not it was literalized is a question that I have. I don't know. We don't know. In other words, was it just a symbol of where we were going, or did they think, no, actually, we will make it to the golden age? Well, it depends probably on who you asked and what culture you were dealing with. Christianity was influenced by that world. So our kingdom of God, or in the Jews, for the Jewish people, the Messianic age, this was their version of the golden age. And there were probably two variations. One is that civilization and culture will get us there. In other words, we can do something about it. Does that sound like any country you've heard of? Okay. Or it's a more hands-off, God will do it, which takes on a slightly more apocalyptic or end times variation that, all right, there's suffering in the world, but God's going to come and give the major smackdown and fix everything. That's probably the first time that's ever been said about end times. Or that's not a common expression of apocalyptic thinking, but that's what it is. God's going to show up and boom, fix the world. That's a development in thought. Now, I'm not making judgments, good or bad. With any kind of human thought, cultural thought, there's a shadow side and a light side. There's something good to, hey, where is society going and can we do something about it? What if we had clean water or hospitals or gymnasiums and libraries and so forth? Those are all Greek. They thought we can make culture better. Now, we'll also enslave people to do it, so there's that. But in any case, I'm not making judgments, good or bad. History had an aim, is what I'm trying to say. I'll say something more about end times, but give me a second. Around the time period of the Industrial Revolution and the Age of Enlightenment and science and so forth, the Golden Age started to look very different. Very much the Industrial Revolution was rooted in this Persian, Greek, Roman, Christian view of a golden age, because we called that progress. One day we'll be able to eliminate all disease and live forever and so forth. That's very industrial. But the view of the universe itself started changing through science. All of a sudden, we realized we're not the center of the universe. And that, my friends, was a kind of profound shakeup in the human psyche that we're still sort of spinning from. What do you mean, I'm not the center of the universe? What do you mean, everything in the universe doesn't revolve around planet Earth or America or Seattle? We still have a hard time with that. I mean, we know that. We're like, yeah, we're not the, you know, we're just like one tiny little corner of the universe, but really, we're kind of a big deal. Because it's a hard fact to face. So along comes a more industrial, linear, scientific, more mechanistic view of the natural world and of where we are heading and what's our relationship with the natural world, until eventually everything gets broken down into particles and resources. After all, we have the Department of Natural Resources. Now you tell me something. Is that an intimate relationship with the created order? The department of whatever the hell I want to use as a resource. The department, it's as if everything, you know, is just for our personal, that's how we've treated the universe. That's how we've treated the earth. And we're now like starting to realize the consequences of that. We didn't really know the consequences of it at first. We're starting to now. So again, a development in thought. So if we take these three things, there's one more. If we take the first three, you can see that there's an increased loss of intimacy from the early cyclical view, where I am actually part of nature. My body is like the moon, if you're a woman. That's a deep kind of intimacy. To the Golden Age is a little more abstract, into the Industrial Revolution, and there's a greater disconnection, a loss of intimacy. And in fact, I remember when I was, you know, a high school teacher, I would sometimes say to my, you know, my students, I was always messing this with them for one thing, but I was like, you're just an animal. Well, that's like offensive. Like, well, I'm not an animal, because we live with this kind of separation. I'm not nature. Nature is something that I do if I like have North Face clothing, and I can go out and visit this thing called nature. We have a hard time even accepting the fact that we are made of natural particles, because it's like kind of freaky. And largely we've lost the intimacy. We've lost the ability to even ask the question, who made the world? So, in the last 50 years, with all the advances in science and technology, we're coming to a much richer view of the universe, and in some ways, more frightening from an existential point of view. And what are we coming to terms with? We're coming to terms with an emergent and evolving universe. And our concept of evolution or time is really messing with us on the psychic level. You're telling me 14.5 billion years? We're talking millions of years, which we can hardly conceive of. Now, billions of years, what is this place? How did we end up here? What happened? I mean, and if you have any kind of theistic notion that there's a God, you have to start thinking, what were you doing all this time? Like, were the dinosaurs like, let's just see what happens, you know? Like, I'm working my way to humans, you know? It's a weird and freaky thing to face up, which is why some people live in denial. And they build creation museums, and they imagine that the Earth is 5,000 years old. Which, if you believe that, you can just say, agree to disagree. But I understand it. I really do understand it, because when you start stretching things out, it feels enormous. And the possibility for existential dread goes up. So what are we coming to learn right now? Those were the four phases: cyclical, golden age, industrial, and now an emergent kind of evolutionary view of the universe, which is just starting to dawn on us. And the major insight, which you saw in the quotation, is that everything is interconnected. Everything. And what we see as separation is an illusion. So Einstein, we could just say, well, he's wrong. What did he know? E equals blah, blah, blah. Or we could say he has a kind of spiritual / scientific intuition about the very nature of reality that continues to be confirmed. That right now in your body, you have particles that are older than your body. Did you know that? When you die and go into the ground, which you will, come to church and learn that you're going to die and go in the ground, something of you will live on. You are deeply, deeply interconnected to everything that is. It's funny because we talk about inclusion, for example, as a cultural phenomenon. It's a scientific reality that you are already deeply intertwined with everyone else, the human and the more than human world, which is the opportunity of our age, is where I'm going with this. It's the opportunity of our age. There's a shadow side, surely, and there's a light side. But the light side is we have the possibility of living in this world differently. Or we can continue to say no and live in denial and in separation and in abstract resources and in scarcity and in fear. Your choice. But a poem like Mary Oliver's is like a call. It's like a raven flying through a canyon, calling out, what is this world? Calling us back into a kind of intimacy. Calling us back into an intimate love affair with reality itself. Even with the cosmos, calling us back to being more like God who loves the cosmos. One of the things that bothers me so much about Christianity, both in its like, I want to escape and go to heaven when I die, and also like in the apocalyptic versions, which is like, at any moment, Jesus is going to suck me up with his vacuum cleaner and I'm going to be out of here, is that it denies the very foundation of Christianity itself, which is the incarnation of Jesus. That God was infleshed, or is infleshed, which is what the word means. In other words, God has no problem from Orthodox Christianity. God has no problem with nature. God is nature. And somehow we've got it in our heads that we'd like to be evacuated. I'll tell you what happened, by the way. I have a chapter in my new book. This is a plug for my new book called Ending End Times and Coming Back to Earth. Here's a short version in case you don't want to read it. We accidentally literalized symbolic words. That's what happened. That's how we got to Left Behind series, shooting up to the clouds. We accidentally literalized symbolic content. So the symbol, there's some power to the symbol in some of these apocalyptic texts like Revelation and Daniel, but we started to read them through the lens of a mechanistic, industrial, historical, scientific lens, which was not available during biblical times. But anyway, side note. Let's come back to the poem. I'll give you a slightly different one. When I was a kid, I grew up in the South, and my dad worked for Jerry Falwell. And he was like, my dad was the vice president of Falwell's school. If you don't know who Jerry Falwell is, you can Google that later and then be frightened. Anyway, the world of fundamentalist Christianity is the world I grew up in. And, you know, like any place, there are good people and bad theology, like a lot of places. But one of the things that was drilled into our heads when we were kids is fear of what we called the rapture, shooting up to the clouds. And we were told that at any moment there'd be a loud trumpet blast and we would be evacuated. And so like any car horn, you know, like you'd be in a panic, you know, or you'd come down, like I'd be playing upstairs in my room and I'd come downstairs and ask my mom a question and she'd like not be there. I'd be like, it happened, I've been left behind. Which is a terrifying way to grow up. And when I moved to Jerusalem, I lived in Jerusalem for 3 years. One time I was at a church and they were talking about some of this stuff and it was like giving me, like I was having like a panic attack inside the church because of what was being said from the pulpit. And I walked outside and tried to clear my head. And the next, few days later, I went to class and I had a class on Jerusalem and the professor said, I want to read a poem. And she had it in her hand in Hebrew. And she said, I'm going to translate it as I go. And I'm just going to give you part of the translation. Here's the poem. One day, I was walking near Damascus Gate, near David's Citadel, with my groceries. And I saw a group of tourists. And their tour guide said this, see that man with the baskets? Just right of his head and up a little bit is an arch from the Roman period. See that man? Sitting there with baskets. Above him is an arch from the Roman period. I said to myself, redemption will come only if their guide tells them, you see that arch from the Roman period? It's not important. But next to it and down a little is a man who bought fruit and vegetables for his family. Somehow this, I cried in class, by the way, which is always like a great thing in graduate school. What's wrong with that guy? There's something so profound about the turn that, this is a poem by Yehuda Amichai, that he, about the turn here. And the turn is what I'm trying to describe. From get me out of here, or I am a separate self, turning back toward an intimacy with all that is. Real redemption looks like noticing human beings buying fruits and vegetables. In other words, a kind of spirituality of the ordinary, is what I would call it, which is what I want to talk about next week. So if you really hate what I have to say, don't come next week, because I'm going to go further. So my question is, now what? Now what? What's our vision of reality? What's our relationship with reality? What's our relationship with nature? And what are we being called back to? What is Mary Oliver calling us to, like this raven flying through the canyon, warning us, calling us, beckoning us, or like Isaiah? Who created all these? Sometimes I feel like what's needed now more than anything else is for us to take Isaiah quite literally and go outside and lay down in the lawn and say, who created all these? But then not answer the question. Instead of saying God and go back inside and get on Xbox, lay down for a while, because what the world needs is more human beings returning to the kind of intimacy that's already present, the kind of interconnectedness that Merton talks about, the kind of oneness of reality that Einstein sort of winks and says, this is actually true, whether you like it or not. Because what's happening now, we all know, in politics and economics and empires, is frightening. It's true. It's frightening. What we're doing to the earth and to our water and to the wind and the waves, it's frightening. It's scary. And actually, it's scary for people on the right and the left, whether or not they know quite how to admit it. I don't think it's a left-right political thing at all. But you cannot begin to fix, if that's even possible, something you're not in love with, something you don't have a kind of intimate connection with. Then it's just an object for you to be for or against. Imagine if you treated an intimate relationship and a marriage like that. I'm here to fix you, and if you could just sort of lay out like your issues and problems, I'll make sure to sort of get to them in due time. That doesn't work. There's no intimacy in that kind of relationship. But the same goes with the natural world. What we need are human beings like us and the generations like our kids starting to fall in love with the world. To learn how to pray in the way that Mary Oliver's talking about. And yeah, there'll be things to do. There'll be problems that have to be addressed. But we won't be treating our relationship with nature in such an abstract way, as a separate self. In some ways, it's a kind of return to what once was. But I think in a deeper way. I'm not about going back, like go back and start hunting, you know, gathering up berries in the woods, okay? That's like not gonna work. There are too many people on the freaking planet for us to like be hunter-gatherers. But, oh, perfect. But there is a kind of return to a kind of intimacy that I think is possible. And in some ways, it's gonna look a little like St. Francis, who calls the sun his brother and the moon his sister. Last night I flew in and I saw my sister, the moon, fully present as she is once a month. God, what a gift. So my hope and prayer is that we will learn to pay attention to the sunrise and to the moon and to the swallows, to submit ourselves in a way. Because the way people talk about evolving they sometimes act like they can do something about it. Like, my thinking has really evolved over the years. As if like a swallow says, you know what, I could really use a split tail. I'm going to start working on that, you know. Evolution is a little bit longer of a, it's the long game. It's not like the quick fix kind of thing. But paying attention and saying yes to reality, to nature, to the human being sitting next to you, and allowing that to shape you, to wash over you, is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Let's end with the poem. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? I mean this grasshopper. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is looking at me with her enormous and complicated eyes. Who thoroughly washes her face and then snaps her wings and flies away. I don't know what a prayer is. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else would you have me do? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Peace be with you.